Yeah.
Yeah.
Who missed Brima more than, you know, like, whatever. I'm trying to think of the term for a spouse when their significant other's off at war.
I saw the Boy Meets World episode where it was in World War II, and I don't remember there being a term.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Atom Dad Podcast. I'm Tyler Wilkinson. We're recording this on Monday evening, and we have not only our full staff in the house, but a special guest. So we'll go in order here. We have Russ Steinberg.
Hello.
And Peter Bard.
What?
And Megan Bard.
Hello.
Our producer, Alex Cohen, as always.
Hello.
And our special guest, who's been on before, we promise it's going to be less painful this time, the lower case half of No Escalators, Kevin Meacham. What's up, buddy?
Hey. How you doing?
I'm great, but we have a lot to talk about today. So, Alex, what's first up?
Well, the first thing we got to talk about is Georgetown in Cincinnati. So it's a little bit of a plus-minus situation there. Georgetown was great. Cincinnati was not so great. But but there are a couple things that both games had in common, and we should talk about those things. So, Megan, why don't you talk about the crowds for both games?
We've been to quite a few games this season, but I feel like the last two, Cincy and Georgetown, were far and away the best the crowds have been all year, really since the end of the AAC tournament. Georgetown in particular was like, it was a really fun game to be at. It did feel like one of those old Big East games. Like, people, I feel like at the beginning of the season, just sort of circled this one on the calendar.
That was the best crowd I've been at a game for since at least 09. I mean, there had to be 10 UCONN chants with Big Red. And there were long, protracted periods of the game where everybody was on their feet and going nuts, you know, for offensive possessions, defensive possessions that seemed critical at the time. People were going nuts. Georgetown was an incredible game to be at. And I think everybody walked away from that game feeling great. And Cincinnati was similar. It was raucous. It was crazy. It was great. It wasn't quite up to the Georgetown level, yeah. but it was.
I did feel like there was some carryover. It wasn't like the games you sort of been to earlier this season where the crowd was just like sitting there and not making any noise and just being generally lame. I feel like both those games were like, I mean, it was a heartbreaker at the end of Cincinnati, but like people were on their feet, like screaming, cheering, going crazy at the end of that game. So
another quick note about the Cincinnati game too, and maybe it felt like that because we were at the game and the crowd was really pissed off, but it felt like the refs were really bad. And I'd like to know from the people who watched on TV, what was the reality? You know, Peter, Russ, Meacham, can you shed any light on that?
The last two plays of the game were pretty damn bad. Especially Miller at the end, he certainly got fouled. And if you're going to call, basically, if you're going to call Facey for what they called him for and then swallow the whistle on the last play of the game with Miller, that just didn't make sense to me. That's the only thing that really stood out in my mind. But I had also, you know, had a few drinks and there were other games playing, and, you know, I probably wasn't the best witness for it.
Kevin Ollie said as much. The first thing he said in his post-game press conference was, it came down to one possession, they called a foul on one end and not on the other. Which is a little too oversimplistic, but I do generally agree that I'm actually of the mind, and I know this is probably an unpopular opinion, but I'm okay with having a loose whistle, like not calling a lot of fouls in end-game situations. It doesn't really bother me, but you can't call different sides of the court differently.
Yeah.
Which I felt was a little fair. By the same token, if you miss 7 of your last 8 shots against a good team, you're probably not going to win a close game.
Yeah, I think that was the story with Cincinnati. I mean, I said to Megan when we got there, I'm going to be surprised if a team hit 60 points tonight. And sure enough, neither team did.
UConn against zones is the most frustrating thing in the world because it literally seems like they run the same exact set every time down against the zone, regardless of his efficiency. Especially, what drives me nuts is just the way they use Hamilton against the zone. They refuse to put him at the foul line, which admittedly is a little bit worse of a play now that, well, when Brima was out. But still, you put your best passer at the foul line, he has the benefit of being 6'7" and can hit a 15-foot jump shot. But instead, they insist on just swinging the ball around the perimeter until there's 10 seconds left. I don't know, maybe this is worth more conversation, but Gibbs is not quick enough to be able to manage those end-of-shot clock situations. He has a really, really hard time getting his own shot at the end of a shot clock, which again just makes it all the more frustrating that they're so willing to kill 20, 25 seconds out of those against zone defense.
I mean, I like Gibbs, and I just don't know if he's that kind of guy that can break down a defense on his own. At least he hasn't shown it here, maybe at Seton Hall, but he just hasn't shown that ability to bail UConn out like the last two point guards we've had.
Well, I'll say this. In the last couple of games where it's come down to the end, Gibbs has gotten to the free throw line a lot, and he makes his free throws. So I'm not really that mad at that call because they had just called the contact on the other end. I mean, putting Gibbs on the free throw line isn't a bad plan, and he'd been able to make that happen in the last couple of games. So, I don't know. I don't know if I think that's actually a bad call.
I mean, I really like Gibbs, but I think the way he functions better in the offense, at least as of late, is when he doesn't have to create his own shots as much. Mm-hmm. If the play was for Gibbs, I'm fully on board, but I would have probably put the ball in Adams or Hamilton's hands with the idea of getting the ball to Gibbs in a better position, as opposed to handing it off to Sterling and letting him try to create it at the end.
I agree.
We're going to go to a mailbag question.
What?
Mailbag says. Pew, pew, pew. This one comes to us from at Koffel. It's our buddy Brian Koffel. He asks, has KO said anything about why Perv is coming off the bench these days? And just to kick us off, I believe the answer to that is no, KO has not said anything.
He said something like, why do you make the decisions you make with the starting lineup? And he says, like, I go with what I feel.
So nobody had the balls. So nobody had the balls to ask, why is Purvis sitting on the bench?
Why did you bench your leading scorer?
He likes bench points.
Tyler, talk to us about how much bullshit that is.
Bench points are fucking stupid. Especially when you have to bench your leading scorer to get them. It doesn't make sense. It's like if you have a Ferrari and you also have a Toyota Corolla and you drive the Corolla all the time and you're like, yeah, but check it out, my backup car is super fucking awesome. Like, it doesn't matter if your first car is a piece of shit.
You guys remember the show Coach?
Yes.
So there was one episode where he's going to a bowl game and he's playing against his old coach. And so his game plan is he's going to pretend his star quarterback is hurt and only bring him in for the last drive of the game. And they're losing, and then they go on that last drive and win the game. They're like, wow, you really fooled them. And I was like, but
you would have won by 25 if you played him the whole game.
Yeah, this probably wouldn't have been close if you hadn't benched him that whole time.
Good thing we let our backup quarterback commit those four turnovers. Really got him where we want him.
You're talking about Tim Boyle?
Wasn't that what Bob Diaco did all last year?
Yeah, pretty much. by the way, Rodney Purvis is no longer UConn's leading scorer. Sean Miller passed him by a tenth of a point.
Yeah, but he was when he was benched.
Yes.
So there was a point in the UCF game where Purvis was on a good run, and I just like in our Slack group, I was like, why the fuck isn't Purvis starting again? Can somebody please explain this to me? And Tyler said, and it was just so, it's comical. It's just he had a bad game once. And it's like, how can that be justification for, what is it, four games now that Purvis hasn't been starting? We've been very frustrated about it on
By the way, I asked Rodney Purvis about this once, if it was basically tough coming off the bench, and he said yes. So not only have you essentially gained next to nothing, but you've disenfranchised one of your best players, at least a little bit. You know, he's only going to say so much in public, and probably for a good reason, but it can't be good when you're essentially an academic senior. You're supposed to be the leader of the team. You want to be the leader of the team. And you have a 1-for-9 shooting night and immediately get benched for the rest of the season.
Maybe there's something going on that we don't know about. Maybe there's something in practice. Maybe there's something that he's trying to accomplish with Purvis by way of doing things this way that I don't know about. So, like, maybe that's a possibility. But given the information that I have in front of me, it strikes me as a dumb decision. Not so much because I think Purvis is probably going to get the same number of minutes whether he starts or not.
Yeah, same with Adams.
But the overriding problem is you might, just like you just said, you end up with a disenfranchised player who is a key player who could really be the leader of the team. Why would you do that? I don't know. You know, we've talked about this ad nauseum in our group. I'm curious as to what Meacham's read is on it, and what he thinks.
Well, I think it would be fine if it worked, but has UConn had a good start since they benched Purvis? Cincinnati, they went the first, what, like 6 minutes without scoring? Georgetown, kind of similar. UCF, they didn't really do much for the first few minutes. I mean, if it worked and if Adams was a spark off the bench and they were up 10-2 in the first few minutes, sure, but it hasn't worked.
Yeah, I mean, and especially, I mean, I really like Jalen Adams, and I think he's starting to come into his own a lot, and we'll talk about this a little more later, but it's not like he was lighting the world on fire in these games he was starting over Purvis. I mean, essentially in the, what is it, 5 games that they've switched, each of them have had 3 good games and 2 average or below average games. So it's not like, I don't know, it's not, I don't really feel like the experiment is working.
Yeah, and also the other thing, too, is that even if you consider that Adams is having a good game, one of the dimensions that Purvis had was that he was able to spread the floor and shoot threes. And you know, Adams really hasn't been that. So
he's made 1 3-pointer in a month. But what actually bothers me the most about this...
2 months.
That's right. Well, going on 2 months. It was December 2nd. You're right. Yeah, 2 months, especially by the time this podcast airs. But what bothers me the most about Purvis not starting was, I can't remember which game it was. Maybe it might have even been the Cincy game where he got really, really hot at the end of the first half. He scored like 9 points at the end of the first half. And then he had to sit the first 8 minutes of the second half. And he came in and he was ice cold and he went like 1 for 9. Like, even if you're committed to bringing him off the bench the first half, what possible reason is there to leave him on the bench when he's your hottest shooter going into the second half against one of the better teams in your conference?
He's coaching. look at him coach. That's what this is. It's very visibly doing. He's tinkering. He wasn't happy with the way things were working out, so he's got to do something. This is something. Therefore, this must be done.
See, I wish he'd tinker more with the offensive sets.
See, I think that the team's performance issues they pretty much coincide with Amita Brima's absence, and I think Purvis is getting scapegoated for the fact that we were missing a very key player in our lineup, and I'd like to hope that now that Brima's back and we saw flashes of what could be in the UCF game that Purvis can work his way back in, because I got to tell you, when he's on and when he's hitting threes and stealing the ball, getting on the break, that is very exciting UConn basketball. And it's really what I enjoy watching. I mean, like, as a UConn fan, when he's in the zone, he's like a throwback UConn guard for me. And he's the only one on the roster who reminds me of watching UConn when I was a kid.
And speaking of Brima's absence, I mean, not to belabor this point too much, but the starting player who performed the worst in that time was Hamilton.
All right, do we want to move on?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, we're actually going to do double mailbag after mailbag. So this one comes from Andrew...
Mailbags on bags.
Yes, yes. This one comes from Andrew Tressler at Tressworthy. Andrew asks, highest seed you see UConn getting in the tourney and likelihood you think UConn will make the tourney? So Peter and Russ and Megan, you all have a lot to talk about on this subject. So why don't you...
Highest seed I could see them getting at this point, if they finish out really strongly, would be a 5 seed. And I am 85% sure that they're going to make the tournament.
Well, part of this too is there's an implied desire to discuss the reaction to the Cincinnati game on Twitter.
Well, people are stupid is the point we're going to make.
Ladies and gentlemen listening to the podcast, this is Russ's moment. This is where he shines. So
now you're putting pressure on. I agree with Peter. I would have said a 5 for the highest seed. I'm 80 to 85% sure that they make it to the tournament. What I wanted to bring up was that it seems like a lot of the non-Joe Lunardi bracketologists that are out there are not quite as high on UConn's chances. and they have them, you know, today as an 11 seed or a 10 seed or 12 seed. And I think they don't, first of all, they don't realize that UConn's resume is a lot better than I think they get credit for. First of all of their losses are to KenPom top 100 teams. They have wins over Michigan, who's starting to look pretty good, at Texas, who beat North Carolina at Texas. Ohio State's starting to play a little bit better. Houston at Houston. Houston's not a bad team. And they have chances. They have one more at Cincinnati. They have two against SMU. They're not in a bad position at all. Now, that's not to say that they have a huge margin for error. In this conference, you really don't. They can't, you know, lose to East Carolina. But you know what? If they drop their games to SMU, it's not the end of the world. And, you know, there's also the American tournament where SMU can't even play. And they could win that and make this whole conversation pointless anyway and just get the automatic bid.
Oh, make no mistake. This conversation is already pointless.
Okay. No, I'll buy that.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of with you guys. I think they're probably going to make it. I mean, 80-85%. It all depends on how they finish out the season, really. Like, if they go in hot, like, people love that story, the, like, you know, the hot team coming out of the conference. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think 5 is unreasonable if something goes real well.
Yeah, and I think the thing that people tend to forget, and, you know, everyone wants to say the American gets no respect, and it hasn't the last couple of years, but this is a 68-team tournament, and there are 36 at-large teams. And if you look at the teams, you know, on the seed list that would be ahead of UConn right now, a lot of them are going to be automatic qualifiers. UConn doesn't have to leap over a ton of teams in order to get into the tournament and get a decent seed. You have to pull 36 teams from somewhere, and there are going to be some teams that don't have amazing resumes, that haven't won on the road against teams in the top 10. That's just how it is with a tournament this big.
Meacham, how many games do you think they lose the rest of the regular season?
I'm going to say... I'll say 3. I think they split with SMU. They lose one of the Memphis-Temple-Tulsa thing, and then they either blow a winnable game against Houston or they lose at Cincy.
The other thing that might play into the committee's decision is that we had to play without Brima for a significant part of the season. And that
look a lot better now going forward with him back. You're gonna take a lot of those losses and go, well, maybe this wouldn't happen. There is a precedent for that.
And it probably wouldn't have happened.
Well, like Wichita, everybody's talking about how Wichita State is gonna get a break because of Van Vliet being out for 5 games or whatever it was, and they were like, what, 1-4 in those games or something like that. Everybody was talking about that on ESPN as if it's like obvious, you know.
And they're saying the same thing about Syracuse when Boeheim was out. I know. The committee has said they will treat that as an injury to a important player.
Yeah.
I think with anything else.
Are they going to do that in 4 years when they're like 15 and 17 under Hopkins? They would have been 23-8.
Syracuse, future Rutgers.
By the way, the Temple loss was by 2 and the Cincy loss was by 1, both at home. I don't think it's that outrageous to say that those games can turn by a margin of 2 or more points if Brima plays. It's not an unrealistic thing to say.
I think especially.
Can I say one more thing about the Cincy game and people being upset for no reason? Jeff Goodman, after the Cincinnati game, tweeted something like, "You know, UConn loses to Cincy. Huskies have been disappointing this year," and that was a 1-point loss to a good team. 2 points swung the other way, and suddenly you're saying UConn has a ton of momentum, is playing really well, and just knocked off one of the best teams in the conference.
That's a disease that sports writers have, is whatever happened was destined to happen. Nothing could have changed this reality. When you see the results of a game, that is a perfectly objective evaluation of the souls of everyone involved. Like if you were better, you would have won. And that's just not the reality of this.
Well,
there's
certainly
a lot of luck and random chance that goes into this. Sometimes the better team loses. Otherwise, somebody would go undefeated every year.
I'm certainly not going to argue with any analysis that has Jeff Goodman with a disease. So. So we're going to talk about the search for the new athletic director. First of all of us at a Dimeback want to say congratulations and good luck to our former athletic director, Ward Manuel.
Thanks for listening, Ward. I appreciate all your
I think it's important that UConn fans understand that this is not a slight against UConn, that he decided to go to his alma mater.
I think people understand that.
I think
there are some people who don't understand that.
I think there's probably plenty of
Boneyard understands that. The only people who don't understand are like posting on current articles.
Well, Andrew, that's below the Boneyard.
In between latently racist comments about Kevin Ollie and Barack Obama, I challenge you to find a story with at least 10 comments where somebody doesn't complain about Barack Obama. In any section of the paper, the obits.
What kind of obit gets that?
The weather, they'll blame him for the weather. Fucking Obama. Why isn't my basketball team good enough? Fucking Obama. It's socialism. That allowed Rutgers to get in.
That might be true, actually.
No, that's the opposite of true. It's definitely capitalism that got Rutgers in. Yeah. It's their fucking capitalist-ass network value.
Listen, as arbiters of good taste here at the Dimeback, and at least some of No Escalators, I think it was important for us to say that the appropriate response to this is to say good luck to Ward Manuel, and to also say that it's not the end of the world. And let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, Oliver Luck is coming in, right?
Peter has sources. He knows about Sterling Gibbs, and he knows about Oliver Luck.
I was very clear about this. I have no sources in the athletic director search.
Peter was right about Zach Brown. He knew it like 4 months ago.
Technically, that's true.
I know.
I mean, you get to brag a little about this. You called that a while ago.
We'll get to that later. All right, jump back into the Oliver Luck thing.
The only thing I heard was that it would be a surprise. I hope that's good. And then it was going to be an unconventional AD choice. And that's just, this is the person who is currently the front runner. So that might not even be.
Who is Oliver Luck?
Oliver Luck was the athletic director at West Virginia. He now is one of the regulatory guys with the NCAA. And he played in the NFL. He was quarterback in the NFL. And his son, Andrew, plays for the Indianapolis Colts, also of the NFL.
Okay.
And I feel like, with Luck, he's still a young guy. He's like 55. If UConn were to hire him, and I know that like the athletic director probably doesn't have a huge role in deciding if you get into a different league or whatever, but if UConn hired him, that I feel like all that, you know, UConn football's a joke, da-da-da-da-da. Well, maybe not. Maybe if this is the guy they're going to bring in to run their athletic department who's very much a football guy, I think it would do good things for the perception of our athletic department from the perspective of schools in Texas and Oklahoma.
Yeah, I agree with that. And going even another way with it, someone who's not a football guy but could have that same effect and I think could do a lot of good things for UConn is Hofstra AD Jeff Hathaway.
Let's see if you can say that so we don't start laughing.
Couldn't get through it.
I said a Hofstra. I was like, wait, uh-oh. Fuck this guy.
Fuck that asshole.
I'm not Just fucking troll the Boneyard more.
I think they're serious. I'm serious. They said they're joking. No, I don't think so.
We said multiple times in the thread that we were joking.
We're just backtracking because we saw how unpopular a pick it was.
Anyone else want to talk about candidates they like? I think we all kind of like Sean Fraser a little bit.
I do. Sean Fraser, I think, is the guy. Like, I don't know if Luck is really an option. I think Frazier's an option.
Yeah.
And I think he's a good one. I know that the Big 12 likes, or the Big 10 likes Frazier. And I think, you know, he makes money and he's a football guy. People will like him in that regard. I think he'd be a good fit for a Northeastern school.
But the Big 12, I guess they're having their meetings this end of this week. This sporting news piece by the horrific Mike DeCourcy today.
Oh, God.
About the possibilities.
Oh, God.
One is no expansion, which I guess is possible, but if that's the case, then something's going to happen in the future, or the Big 12, or Oklahoma is going to bolt. But another possibility is UConn and Cincinnati.
I like the third possibility, though.
The third possibility would never happen, and that is UCF and USF, which is possibly the dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard.
Is it dumber than Houston and Memphis?
Slightly.
Slightly. I think so because of this. I think UCF isn't crazy, but USF, a school that isn't good at anything.
I mean, they're no. It's no worse a choice than UCF.
Okay, but if you're already adding UCF...
Yeah, I wouldn't add both.
What else does USF give you? Because you're already in Florida. That's why you would want to add UCF. Am I wrong?
Listen, I think you guys...
Yeah, I would think so.
I think you guys are being too dismissive of Houston. Did you know that in the early 80s, they had some great basketball players go to their school?
Houston used to be a real deal athletic program. I mean, if you were to
in the early 80s,
you got to understand that if you were to do like a comparison, who got fucked the most in conference realignment, UConn and Houston are 1 and 1A, because the Southwest Conference was one of the best conferences in college athletics, and they were one of the handful of teams that got left out when Texas and Texas Tech and Baylor and A&M joined up with the Big 8. And then all those teams ended up in, like, fucking Conference USA and became mid-major athletic programs. Now that they're a little elevated, they've turned into a real program again. I think they would do well in the Big 12. I just think don't think that that helps the Big 12.
And Texas would never allow it.
Yeah, what is Texas is already losing the recruits to Houston as a member of the American Conference. Texas wants to steal their head coach and then bury them again. This is not... Texas isn't going, oh, good, Houston's good. Let's bring them into the league, too. Let's make our jobs a little bit harder while we're already struggling.
Okay, was that it on realignment? Do we want to talk about anything more with realignment?
We really need fucking Notre Dame to need to join a league.
That's my favorite fantasy. That's my favorite fantasy, the one that has Notre Dame having some like horrific thing happen to them in the postseason in football because they don't play in a conference bowl game, and they finally decide that it's time to sack up and join a conference, and they're like, all right, ACC, we'll play ball, and they're like, oh, hey, UConn, come hang out with us.
Are there any meetings or decisions that the NCAA is going to make or anything like that anytime soon that could push Notre Dame to that, or is it really just like if they get fucked over in the next college football playoff?
Well, it's not even fucked over. The rules for the college football playoff say that an independent or a non-conference championship should be considered for the playoff only if they are clearly one of the four best teams. The guidelines for the college football playoff state that if, you know, a non-conference champ or independent should only be considered if they're clearly one of the four best teams.
It seems like flimsy. That seems like flimsy language.
Yeah, but that means that some people are going to say, if I'm not sure, then I go with the conference champ. And that's going to make it very difficult for Notre Dame to make a playoff unless two of the power conferences have shitty years. Or something weird happens in at least two of those games. They're going to have a hard time squeezing in. And I think that they're going to recognize if we join the ACC, and we're a one-loss team, we win our conference championship, we're definitely in. Fucking Notre Dame, a one-loss conference champ Notre Dame is absolutely not being left out of the CFP.
You all are much more well-read on the scenarios and permutations of what could possibly happen, but as the person who's listening to all this, the likeliest scenario by far to me sounds like if the Big 12 votes to expand.
That's the only one where I think in the short term they're probably going to add. I don't think that the Big 10 or the ACC are looking to add teams right now.
Why would the NCAA never make a rule that says you have to win your conference championship? I'm just curious.
Because Notre Dame's not in a conference.
Yeah, but
the only person it would
that's one vote.
Yeah, but it's an important one.
Yeah,
and the Big Ten's not going to vote for them. The Big Ten's not going to want to force Notre Dame to join the ACC and vice versa. And
okay.
Nobody wants them to join any of these conferences, so I just don't see it happening.
All right, quickly before we, so one thing we got to touch on. So we already talked about Georgetown and Cincinnati, but we should also talk about Central Florida, the Central Florida game. We don't have to talk a lot about the game, but there are two very important things that came out of that game. And one was that Jalen Adams had a very good game. And the team looked rejuvenated with Amita Brown.
I thought you were going to say the two important things were a tackle fall and Justin McBride.
UConn had a basketball contest against the UCF Hagrids. And
They have
giant people on their roster. But the two relevant things for UConn fans who are looking at this team and looking at the possibilities going forward are that, one, Jalen Adams had a very good game, and two, the team looks rejuvenated with Brima back in the lineup. And Brima, to my eyes, looked like he hadn't really lost a step. Looked very good.
I guess we should establish first a baseline, right? Which is that UConn just played 11 games without Brima,
yeah,
and they're still one of, like, I think the Sports Reference defensive win shares or some sort of defensive metric has them as, like, a top 10 defensive team in the country. And this is without Brima, who I assume before the year we all would have said is their clear best defensive player. What do you make of that, Meacham?
Well, I think it's a couple things. The idea of not having that block monster, under the rim, kind of forces you to play a little bit tougher on defense, stay in front of your man, not let him go by you. I think that's part of it. I think some of it is the defensive rebounding has been a little bit better because you don't have someone selling out for the block, whether they get it or not. It just seems like the with Brima being out, it's also been better defensive guard play. I think Gibbs is way better defensively than he was at the start of the year. I think it's just all those things in tandem.
As far as, they didn't look great defensively earlier in the year, but that's not just because Brima was there. It's also because they had to adjust the way they played defense because with the fouls being called, remember how many fucking fouls we were getting called for early in the year? Mm. And now they don't do that as much. But that has nothing to do with who's playing center. If anything, not having that would make them foul more.
I think we have a good old-fashioned throwdown on the Adineback podcast right now.
Yeah. Come at me, bro. But no, my point is just that I wouldn't necessarily assume that that's a causation situation.
Yeah, I don't think you can say definitively that it is a causation. It's just kind of interesting, and I think some of it has been the guard. It might just be the guard have been playing better on defense, and they've not been fouling, and they've not been getting beat as bad as they were back in November, December.
I'll say this though, especially in the first half, the alley oops were back. And it wasn't just
Brima. I missed those so much.
And it wasn't just Brima. I mean, Brima had a few of them, but the one to close the half out to Miller.
So if you go by opponent's points scored or points allowed, UConn's the best defensive team in the AAC, and UCF is the worst.
Yep, that sounds about right.
With a full 11 points in between them.
Well, UCF averages, 75 points a game? Or they did going into our game? It was something like that. So...
UCF averages 73.5 in conference.
So our defense on them was positively UConn women-like.
Meacham, what are your thoughts on Jalen Adams?
I like him.
All right. Thanks for joining us on that podcast.
No, he's an important part of the team because he does things that no other guard on this team can do. And which, when he's in, the offense gets a different dimension. You know, it'd be nice for him to play with Purvis and Gibbs maybe at the same time.
I'm
very excited for the next couple of years to see him be the, you know, 1-2 guard, depending on, I guess, Gilbert would be the one most of the time.
Is there anything we want to say about Zach Brown?
You're all welcome that I knew about this and told you all.
Totally.
Like a wonderful, magnanimous, perfect human that I am.
Oh, my God. No, I'm sorry. You're not Rebecca Lobo status. Dial it down.
Well, close second. Brown is good. He's raw. He's going to hope. I don't know if I'm hoping he reclassifies to 2016. Because, I mean, it would be nice to have an extra player on the team next year, but we don't really have a need for another big man if Brima comes back, because we're going to have Diarra coming in, Durham, and still have Enoch and Facey.
It would probably be nice for Diarra to get some minutes as a freshman to get some development, I would think.
And Enoch.
Well, Enoch too, but I think that
a lot of guys who need minutes to develop, and you add another guy who needs minutes to develop to that group, I'm not sure that's the best solution. Now, they could bring him in, have him redshirt for a year, but I don't generally see that helps people a lot. Like, unless they need to physically develop, which he definitely does not need.
He's not a one-and-done, though, is he?
No. I mean, maybe if he'd never gotten hurt and he had continued to develop, he might be by now, but at this point...
And he'd also be going to Kentucky.
Well, no, they got Wenyen Gabriel.
Oh, yeah.
At this point, even if he played, he's not a one-and-done. I think he's probably going to be a 2 or 3 year guy.
Meacham, can we look forward to a well constructed tweet regarding the Duke, both men's and women's teams not being ranked right now?
I'm still brainstorming. The process takes a lot of time.
Yeah,
we have ghostwriters for all these tweets.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening to the Adirondack Podcast. Don't forget, every Friday you can read the Adirondack Mailbag. All right, Russ is going to prison, so he won't be on the next podcast, but Meacham's going to be his permanent replacement. So Meacham, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, until next time, thanks for listening to the Adirondack Podcast.